atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Kayleigh McEnany in studio. If you're smart enough to get Fox Nation, you're seeing the stream right now. Or if you're on your app, you just click on watch and just page over until you get to Fox News Radio. Bottom of the hour, Byron York will be here. Kayleigh, great to see you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And here are the big, we're just coming off Fox and Friends together. Here are the big three that you need to know.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The Justice Department is seizing 32 internet domains that the Russian government and the Russian-sponsored actors have used to engage in a covert campaign to interfere and influence the outcome of our country's elections.
That's the dulcetary tones of Merrick Garland. Here we go again. Russia is already interfering in our election, according to our Justice Department. The FBI is taking action. But is it real or a distraction? We'll examine.
Number two.
Jerusalem Post is reporting that you're 90% there in negotiations with Hamas towards a ceasefire deal. Would you say that's accurate?
No, it's exactly inaccurate.
I just interviewed Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on the latest ceasefire deal negotiations. You will hear more momentarily, and I'll explain why it's in everyone's interest for him to stand strong and remain on the Gaza-Egypt border, known as the Philadelphia Corridor. Plus, pro-Hamas protesters at home as Hillary Clinton is now targeted.
Number one.
So here's the detail. If you earn $1 million a year or more, the tax rate on your long-term capital gains will be 28% under my plan.
Really? Fantastic. Tracking the trail. Trump in New York giving a major economic speech while Harris starts debate camp. We review the rules of next week's face-off as the VP tries to separate herself from beloved Joe Biden. So, Kayleigh, a lot going on. Today, the president's going to make an economic speech, get into more details. But we're still waiting for a lot of details from Kamala Harris.
Yeah, we know socialist price controls is part of the plan. We know tax hikes. We know expiration of the Trump tax cuts, which is a tax break for every income level. People don't realize it, but yes, indeed, there was
Tell
a tax break.
Tell us me
break.
About the, you had that number on the middle class
yes.
tax cut. What did they get?
So if you make between $15,000 and $50,000, you had about a 16% tax break. It was a range, but that was the low end of it. Between $50,000 and $100,000, you had a 17% tax break. That was the low end of it. So you will see more money out of your paycheck in a Kamala Harris presidency. On top of the corporate tax rate, the capital tax rate, all of that comes down, trickles down. But that is a direct tax increase you will have because of Kamala Harris.
So unrealized gains. This is a big one. So if you have a big year, you start this company, it's worth $200 million estimate. But you don't have that money. You're building a company. And all of a sudden, you know, at the end of the year, I'm paying 25% of that if Kamala Harris gets her way. So you have to do what? You got to sell that company because I have no way of paying that because I have a hypothetical company that's net worth is a certain amount, but I can't get money out of that unless I sell it. And even Ro Khanna comes out and says, do we really want to do this? This guy is as liberal as he's basically a socialist, and he says you can't do this.
Yeah, this isn't just capital gains where you sell your home, and if you don't buy a new one, you get taxed on that money that is in your pocket. To your point, it's unrealized. It is money that you do not have that you will be taxed on. This is a far, far, far left strategy. Totally agree with Donald Trump. He said last night twice, this is going to take us back to 1929 depression levels when you combine that with price controls.
Right. So just in terms, it's just so people know, she did put out some numbers. So right now, the top tax rate is 37% without state tax, obviously. Now it's going up to 39.6 under her plan. Unrealized gains at 25%. Corporate tax, they say it's as low as 15%, but it's at 21%. You guys brought it down to 21%. Mm-hmm. She wants to jack it up to 28%. So what people should understand is we're not taxing rich corporations. Those corporations are the ones that hire people, whether it's the janitor, the vice president, the intern. If you make it conducive for corporations to thrive here in America, they hire more people, they put more money into their company, they grow the company. If you won't tax in that company, you get more dividends, but they feel as though it's too low at 21%. But China is at 21%. Ireland's at 18%. Mm-hmm. We were the fourth highest at 35% before Trump took over.
Yeah, and those cuts will come somewhere. And it's not going to be on, it may be the paycheck, it may be jobs. Those cuts are going to come somewhere in the company, and it will directly hurt you. But, you know, that's her plan. And it's crazy. You know, she puts out this price control plan, widely derided, even by the Washington Post editorial board. Can't remember this last time, you know, they came out hard against a leftist. And you compare that with what Trump's going to announce today. And you compare that with the prosperity of the Trump years, where every single group, Black, Latino, every group had made gains in wages, which were outpacing the 1.4% inflation rate we had.
Here is Kamala Harris talking about something else she wants to do for small business. Cut eight.
And the current tax deduction for a startup is just $5,000. Okay? So then you got to make up the delta there. Got to figure out how you're going to do that. Not everyone has access to that kind of wealth and capital. So part of my plan is we will expand the tax deduction for startups to $50,000. It's essentially a tax cut for starting a small business.
They say it'll cost $1.7 trillion.
Yeah. Yeah, add to the national debt more and more. And, you know, on top of that, that's a great idea. Look, yes, I believe in starting small businesses and getting these tax breaks. But if you've lost individual income coming in via a loss of a Trump tax cut, what money do you have to invest to then get a tax rate? And that's before we get to the unrealized gains you mentioned.
Right. So right now it's one interview, 16 minutes with Tim Walz there, who's been an epic fail as far as I'm concerned. What does it say about that team that he will not answer any questions? Do you see what happened yesterday? The governor was people that were told before he was appearing, his daughter's here, don't ask him any questions. Really?
It's not about policy. It's not about transparency. This is about vibes. This is pure and simply a vibes campaign. They want the vibe as we're the new ticket, the compelling ticket. You want to be with us. We're out on TikTok. It's a vibe. It's a cultural movement they're trying to create. And in order to do that, you have to be short on policy details and provide no transparency. That's why it's a 17-minute interview. By the way, he got, what, three questions, by the way? He barely spoke. It was incredibly awkward.
And one of the things was about his own record, and he said that his grammar's bad. I mean, he should have. And you know this. You do. You're an expert crisis manager. You think on your feet as quick as anyone in the country. But he had to have pre-thought that he's going to get that question about his service.
Yes.
And he said, my wife is on me to keep my grammar straight. So that didn't quiet any of the critics.
No. And the Harris campaign, what was so odd about that, came out and said he misspoke when he talked about facing weapons of war in war. He was very clear about that. The campaign says he misspoke. And then he decided to just change the explanation to "I have bad grammar." It makes no sense when you compile that one remark with all the other times he has inflated his military service, which there are, I would say, at least a dozen that I have found.
Right. And you know what? Let the former Marine do it. You know, they're going to come at Trump and talk about Vietnam or that era. But I just think that they were, like you said to me in the break, can you imagine if they pick Governor Shapiro in Pennsylvania? Even on the CNN poll, it's tied at 46 in Pennsylvania. I never remember Trump tied even against Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania. He's up 5 in Arizona. But the other battleground states, including North Carolina, are in the margin of error. I think Wisconsin might be above the margin of error. What do you think happened there?
Yeah, you know,
For Harris.
You know, I think what happened in Wisconsin is this state was kind of trending a little bluer. But needless to say, this is a state where Trump was ahead, or rather the Democrat was ahead in Wisconsin by far more than where Trump is now. So it's still a margin of error race. The biggest mistake that Kamala Harris made was not picking Governor Shapiro. I mean, look, you look at the map and Politico Playbook laid out 17 paths for her, some number like that, 15 paths for her, and almost all of them except two or three required Pennsylvania. The biggest mistake she has made is letting her ego overtake what was a mathematically right decision and picking the popular governor of Pennsylvania who is outperforming you with all demographics.
But you know why?
Because her ego.
Right. I mean, it's clear he is better than her.
Yes.
More experienced than her, more sure of himself than her. And he really is on the right side of a lot of things on foreign policy. He also acted great after the assassination attempt. I thought he acted in a bipartisan way. So it's, you should never feel that insecure to think my number two is going to outshine me.
Yeah, and the reporting is Tim Walz came in and said, I want to do this. I essentially want to serve you. I'm paraphrasing. But Shapiro
and I don't want to be president.
And I don't want to be president. Exactly. And Shapiro came in and said, what's the job going to be like? What are my day-to-day responsibilities? Will I be the last person in the room with you? She didn't like that. She wants a subservient vice president, which is why she chose Tim Walz. What a horrible choice. Despite, I will say, in polling, he has high likability, which I just simply don't understand on a personal level. But the polling does reflect that. But it's not helping her win the swing states.
Right. Minnesota, she is does worse. She still beats Trump, but does worse with Walz on the ticket, which shows you about what they think of him. Kaylee, I know you have to go. It turns out there is a point where people get sick of me, and you've reached that point. 3 hours in the morning and then 15 minutes on radio. I think we've hit that threshold.
Never sick of you because I'm on One Nation with you this Saturday.
Yeah, but we have at least some time off. Yeah, yes. Saturday night, 9 o'clock.
A little break.
Kaylee, thanks so much. You're doing Outnumbered, though, right?
Yes.
Coming
I'll
up at noon.
Yep.
Kaylee McEnany, don't move. Kaylee's got to go. Byron York at the bottom of the hour. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So, New Hampshire, we have 62 days to go. 62 days to go. This race is going to be tight until the very end. So please, let's not pay too much attention to the polls because we are running as the underdog.
Right. That's a mindset and that's maybe smart, but I don't think it's accurate. What she's trying to do is run out the clock with the slight lead and hope to win in those seven battleground states. They think going in polling with the polling as a slight lead, that'll be enough, and it's not worth the risk of sitting down doing interviews, taking questions after events, doing press conferences, town halls. So she thinks right now, if she comes out of the debate unscathed and, you know, even, she's not doing anything. I mean, that might be the only interview. And unless you guys demand it, that includes moderates, undecideds, and her supporters, which I think you should demand. Can you imagine hiring somebody, even if it was a family member, without an interview? If you cared about your company, you would never do it. If you cared about your country, you would never allow it. Donald Trump didn't do interviews or town halls or any press conferences. Nobody would want him as president. He wouldn't have a shot. They'd be killing him on all the mass media channels. But instead, there's no clamor for her to do anything except that 16 minutes when she sat down with her running mate. Susan, listen to WHIO in Dayton. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Brian. It's Susan. The corporate tax rate in Southern Ireland is actually 12.5%. I was a manufacturing recruiter for 20 years, and there are over 700 U.S. corporations have moved their corporate headquarters to Southern Ireland because of that. And
now, by the way, honestly, Susan, how many moved out when we dropped it to 21%?
I don't think many did, but some did. But I actually think that there's more than 700 now. I haven't looked at it for about a year, but I just double-checked the corporate tax rate. And at one point, the manufacturing corporate tax rate was 10.5, and non-manufacturing was 12.5. And so when Trump lowered it to 21, that was great. That stopped the bleed. But really, if, in my opinion, having worked in manufacturing recruiting for over 20 years, they need to drop it to 15. That would really, really skyrocket manufacturing here. And that would bring manufacturing back in droves. And it would also attract other countries' manufacturing to come here and build their plants here.
I would love to see that drop down. What people think is you're giving rich people more money. It's just not the way corporations work. These are people that work in those corporations. You want to bring them here for the jobs, correct?
Absolutely, especially in manufacturing is the lifeblood of, and then also you've got all the small businesses, and they make up a huge portion of the employers in America. And so that corporate tax rate doesn't just affect big companies, it affects little companies as well.
Yeah, thanks so much. Appreciate the insight, Susan. Real world advice. Kevin listening, hold it. I'm not going to go to Kevin. I want to go hear from J.D. Vance. Here's J.D. Vance yesterday in Mesa, Arizona. He talked about what is going on with Harris, her vision on the economy, and also J.D. Vance talked about the whole war against energy. Despite what you're hearing about fracking, despite what you hear about production, when we get, we're not close to capacity. Innovation have allowed us production to increase, but the pipelines, the exploration, the financing and the financing and the red tape around drilling has made it very tough on energy, and it's affecting all of our energy bills. Cut five.
She's also, of course, gone to war against American energy. And energy goes into everything, right? You want to manufacture anything, you need energy. Our farmers want to transport food to the grocery store, they got to do it on trucks. The trucks require energy. So when you raise the cost of energy, then you raise the cost of everything else. Kamala Harris would rather us buy oil and gas from tin pot dictators all over the world. I think we ought to buy energy from American workers and from American territory.
And that's what lowering the corporate rate would do. But also these companies, what you have to do is not make it prohibitive, cost prohibitive, in order to get the financing to do these drills. Because keep in mind, they basically shut down new drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And why have they done that? Because they've made it almost impossible to do any exploration because they're pressuring banks not to give financing when it comes to this because they don't want the fossil fuel industry to flourish, even though it's in their best political interest to do it and they're giving lip service to it. People should understand that action does tell a story, and you should not talk about production. You should talk about how close to capacity. And that's just it. We don't know exactly what she'll do. We just know she'll say anything through her surrogates to get elected, something that drives Ari Fleischer nuts. Cut 13.
I've come to the conclusion that there's only two things that the press is interested in this election. One is they want abortion to be legal, and two, they want to defeat Donald Trump. That's all they need. If Kamala Harris can deliver those two, that's good enough for them, and they don't have to interview her. They don't have to ask her tough questions about policy. They don't have to see what she would do for America and the world if she were elected president, the way the press has always tried to do its job. This is how deep the press is in the tank, and it's just over those two issues. Defeat Donald Trump, keep abortion legal, and everything else is fine. That's America's press corps today.
Wow.
And that's the Democrat vote for Harris, too.
And what really bothers me most is that it's not pressure. You could decide maybe the follow-up question frustrate me, the lack of follow-up questions, especially when you look at Meet the Press. But what I think frustrates me more is that there's a lack of demand among just average journalists, local or national, for her to sit down and answer some questions. And you saw it with Jonathan Curl on Sunday, who fills in for George Stephanopoulos, who never does his own show. And he was just saying, well, do we know? Do we know what she stands? Do we know why she changed her position? We don't know. She doesn't tell us. And you hear some frustration with it, but they would never tolerate it with Trump. And what they spent their weeks on, and I watch the other channels, they've been focusing on Arlington, which is boomeranged in their face. They said, well, Trump shouldn't have used it as a photo op. Family stepped up and go, he didn't use it as a photo op. He used it. We asked him to come to the grave, and we took pictures. They ended up putting it out. So the more you talked about Arlington, you talked about who didn't show up in Arlington. Kamala Harris, who was in her house in D.C., and Joe Biden, who wouldn't leave the beach. It would have taken him 20 minutes to get there, who never read a report or explained himself why he had to evacuate that way from Afghanistan. So every time they brought up Arlington and the controversy, it became bigger than the explosion at Abbey Gate. And what did he did, and why were you responsible?
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
She wants to raise corporate taxes. She wants to raise small business taxes, capital gain taxes, estate taxes, the international corporate minimum tax, to the point where America won't be competitive anymore. And your tax cuts are about to expire in 2025. Yeah. What does this mean for the economy? What does it mean for everybody here struggling?
So I gave you the biggest tax cuts in the history of our country. If you let the Trump tax cuts expire, which he wants to do, she wants to terminate them. If you do that, you will suffer the biggest tax increase in history.
So that was a little of the town hall yesterday that Donald Trump did with a very supportive crowd in Harrison with Sean Hannity. Byron York joins us now. Fox News contributor, chief political correspondent with the Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome back. Let's talk about what's happening in 6 days. We have a debate. It looks like that's going to be the only time we see these two together, and maybe the only time we see Harris unscripted. What are the odds of that?
I think the odds of that are actually pretty good. I mean, she's done this one dual joint interview with Tim Walz on CNN. And then she went into debate preparation. She's apparently camping out in Pennsylvania for like 5 days prior to the debate to prepare. And then, of course, it'll be the final sprint of the campaign. So I can easily see her not agreeing to any interviews after that. As far as debates are concerned, you know, Donald Trump called for 3 debates. He called for one that would have been a couple of days ago, September 4th. And then there is this one September 10th on ABC, and there was called for another one on Fox News, I believe, on September 17th. And all Kamala Harris would say was that the only one she would agree to is the ABC debate on September 10th, and that she might think about doing another debate after the ABC debate. I mean, this is, we've never quite seen a stance like this toward debates and media exposure that we've seen from the Harris campaign.
Because they, you know, they feel anything to win, and if the only thing that would smoke her out is if they start falling behind in the polls. Like, for example, in Pennsylvania, they got to be stunned. More and more, it looks like Trump is going to be successful there. They're tied at 46. A lot of game has to be played. I got it, but they're not pulling away. I mean, Trump was never leading Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania until he beat her. So I'm very curious to see what happens there. And we just got to find out where she stands. You wrote a column today. Just talk about what she has talked about in the past. Remember, she supported guaranteed income. And she told Al Sharpton she's for reparations nationally. Now, we know in California they tried it experimentally. Then they realized they couldn't do it, so they're trying to back out of it. New York is even entertaining it. But, I mean, we haven't even asked her about that. You write that.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, she's been running for president, I guess, for 45 days now, which is nothing, I mean, you know, compared to what a normal presidential campaign is like. And she has not received, during this long 45-day campaign, she has not received any of the really intense scrutiny that other major party candidates, every single one who has reached the nominee stage, has gone through in previous elections. And even her previous run for president, it's the 2020 campaign, but she never got out of 2019. She ran for president in 11 months of 2019 in the Democratic primary. Even that has not gotten a lot of scrutiny. And what I looked at was a couple of issues that she talked about extensively in the 2019 campaign. And the one was reparations, and the other one was actually quite closely linked to that, which was a guaranteed income. And yes, she said that she favored reparations, but specifically she favored a bill that would set up a reparations commission, a national reparations commission. She favored a bill that would do that in the House, and she actually co-sponsored one in the Senate. But she actually sponsored her own bill, a bill called Lift the Middle Class Act. And LIFT stood for Livable Incomes for Families Today. And basically, it would have set up a monthly payment of up to $500 a month. You just get a payment of $500 every month from the government for millions and millions of couples if they have income below $100,000. And this was in addition to any other government transfer payments they might receive. And liberals who favored what was called a universal basic income were absolutely thrilled with this, because it wasn't exactly a universal basic income, but it was darn close.
Yeah.
And it was as close as they were going to get from any Democrat. And the other thing was, she sold this to me in media interviews as a part of a reparations agenda. So all of this stuff was going on in plain sight in 2019, and nobody has talked about it in the 45 days she's been running for president so far.
Right, and that was then, this is now. And what she does is sends out Governor Polis and Ro Khanna, and she hasn't fleshed out her flip-flops, nor has she defined them. So they have no answers. You know, Mark Kelly. I mean, yesterday we were playing a clip from Mark Kelly on another network saying, they said, well, didn't she say that she was for decriminalizing border crossing? He goes, well, it was just a quick decision she made. I had to put her hand up at a debate. you know, it was one of those quick decisions you make. You haven't really think about it. Oh, we're not going to have any quick decisions when it comes to being president. And by the way, decriminalizing border crossings would affect millions of people.
Yeah, and she was in favor of other decriminalization measures. She was in favor of decriminalizing what some Democrats call sex workers, and also decriminalizing marijuana. So decriminalizing illegal border crossings was not just completely out of blue for her. So I think when she raised her hand, and she did indeed do that, I think she was actually indicating a considered position and not any sort of spur of the moment thing.
So there's a story out yesterday, Byron York, that Republicans, many Republicans, want Trump to lose and lose big so they could turn the page or go back in time. Here's what James Carville said about that. Cut 11.
The Republicans got blown out in 64 and won the presidency in 68. Democrats got blown out in 72, won the presidency in 76. So what I tell my Republican friends, if you want your party back, if you want a kind of pro-business, lower tax, lighter regulatory cuts, you know, stand erect at attention during the anthem, the only way you're going to get that back is through a blowout. If Harris gets 280 electoral votes, it's not going to change. And I think there's a growing recognition of that, not just from kind of elite Washington never-Trumpers, but there's getting to be a sense of that on the ground also.
Do you think he knows what he's talking about when he comes to Republicans?
Well, it's an opinion. You know, a lot of people have opinions. I disagree with this one. I mean, when I looked at the article this is based on and some of the conversation about it, it was like some Republicans want to lose big so they can go back to losing the old-fashioned way. The article does point out that Republicans have lost the popular vote in every election except 2004 since 1988, I believe.
Right.
They've won it one time, George W. Bush's reelection campaign in 2004. Also, if you go from 1984 to 2016, which is, what, 32 years, the only Republicans who won the presidency were Bush's. And so I think this is there's in some corners of the Republican Party, I guess there's a Bush-like nostalgia. But in my opinion, the presidency of George W. Bush was so disastrous it actually led to what later became the Trump MAGA movement, because you had a disastrous war in Iraq, followed by a financial collapse. I just think that it did enormous damage to the Republican Party. So the idea that you could somehow go back, that a blowout loss in 2024 would somehow get the Republican Party back to where it was, the Republican Party was in a terrible way after the 2012 election and was going nowhere. So you have to think about a post-Trump Republican Party, because Trump's 78 years old. You have to think about that. But my guess is it's going to be some sort of synthesis of the changes Trump has made with more traditional Republican Party doctrine.
As you write about, Byron, you know, Republicans used to be very free trade. They used to have a different philosophy. They have a different philosophy on a bunch of things. But the people that ran in the primary against Trump were pretty much in agreement with Trump on most issues. So, you know, the Liz Cheney, the Never Trumpers, the Adam Kinzingers were not leading a insurgent cause. They were just anti-Trumpers. So I didn't see many people diverging from the Trump agenda outside foreign policy, right?
Yeah, you make an excellent point. I mean, something like the Trump tax cuts was basically Trump giving Paul Ryan, you know, what the tax cut that he had favored for years. And I think if you go back and look at the traditional sort of Republicanism they want to return to, it is a Republicanism of George W. Bush, of John McCain, of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. And so Trump on policy, I mean, if you look at Mitt Romney's votes in the Senate, I think he voted with Trump. I can't say this off the top of my head, but it's over 80% of the time. So there's an enormous amount of policy agreement in these two sides.
Yeah, I mean, when you look, too, at the border, remember for the longest time they do the autopsy on the Republican Party and they decide, stop with the tough on the border rhetoric. The Hispanic population is misinterpreting it. And now he said, well, screw that. They're not sending us their best. We're building a wall. And he says what he says. And now everybody's saying that. And there's nobody who's weak in the border. And the Hispanic vote has never been stronger for any Republican candidate.
That was a disastrous mistake. After the 2012 election, when Romney did poorly among Hispanic voters, they did a so-called autopsy. And the autopsy, very specifically, the RNC said, this is not about policy. We're talking about logistics and voting and turnout and that kind of stuff. But they made one exception to their rule, and they called for immediate comprehensive immigration reform, which was really a bad mistake on their part. And I think what Trump showed is that a lot of Americans support border security, including a lot of Hispanic Americans. And the way to campaign with Hispanic Americans, as it is with any minority group, is to show up, go to them, talk to them, and tell them the same thing you're telling everybody else. Do not pander. Do not create very specific policies for this group or that group. Give them the same message everybody else, but show up, you know, acknowledge they exist. They're important. You want to hear what they have to say, but give them the same policy agenda as everybody else.
And Byron York, before I let you go, just the debate rules are out from ABC.
Yeah.
It'll be 90 minutes. There'll be due commercial breaks. No opening statements. So there'll be closing statements. Got to be under 2 minutes. No props or pre-written material. You can have a water. You can have pen and paper, but nothing pre-written. There'll be no audience. Campaign staff may not interact with the candidates during commercial break. Candidates will have two-minute answers to questions, two-minute rebuttals, and one extra minute for follow-up clarifications and responses. That's where I believe ABC will insert themselves or not. Because they'll come out and try to fact check one candidate and not the other. I think we know what that would be, that 1 minute extra for follow-up clarification and responses. So I'm wondering if that's when the when more aggressive moderators might weigh in. Your thoughts about these debates and your thought about the debate 6 days away.
Well, first of all, the two-minute stuff, that's a lot of time for a candidate to make a position, and they should be able to say what they mean about any particular subject in 2 minutes. So I think that's good. What you just said is correct in the sense that if the moderators want to insert themselves into the debate, that's when the follow-ups are when they can do it. You know, Trump himself has said the CNN debate was, he thought, very fairly moderated. You know, and he was calling Jake Tapper, fake Tapper before that. And then afterwards he said, well, actually it was a very fair debate. And I agree it was a very fair debate. And that's really a model for how this one should be conducted because, look, the thing that made the CNN debate a horror story for Democrats was Joe Biden's senility. It wasn't how the debate was conducted. So this one should probably go along the same lines. We'll see if that's what happens.
All right, Byron York, we'll look forward to your columns and insight along the way, 6 days away. Byron York, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. I'll get some calls in just a moment. Also, what Russia has been accused of doing. And David Spunt's question, which I think says a lot. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Russia today sent a statement to Fox News and some other outlets here mocking the situation. They had five bullet points or six bullet points. The first said, ha, 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 ha. 2016 wants its cliches back. In all seriousness, there is a subsection of the country that when they hear Russian interference, they may believe that it's not true. It's not a real thing. How do you assure people this is a real situation?
I'm sure that was much funnier in the original Russian, but for us, it's not funny. This is deadly serious, and we are going to treat it accordingly.
Well, I mean, you are treating it accordingly. You're pressing charges against two people. You're saying Russia has already interfered in the election. All right, I'm not saying it's not true, but your track record, not you, Merrick Garland in particular, but track record is not great. We know that they are accused of guerrilla marketing for not necessarily tapping into anyone's election or any votes or anyone's ID, but they're going to try to help a unnamed political party. They're trying to get people to think that you're losing the American way. Talk about Ukraine is overspending on foreign policy that it's really none of our business. Try to manipulate the American public. 71 pages in the affidavit, 32 internet domains cited, 200 pages of exhibits alone. The Justice Department filed charges against just two people, saying that they used for foreign malign influence, allegedly directed by the Russian government. Garland said that the RT, which is their network, and two employees implement a $10 million scheme. So they're all over it. But to come out and say Russia is manipulating our election again when they really were over, they were overcharged, for lack of a better word, in 2016. They were manipulating. They bought $1 million worth of Facebook ads. They were trying to do stuff with the election, but you gave them full credit for Donald Trump winning. Hillary Clinton never stopped. Most Democrats never said that he won. Until 2020 happened and Biden wins, you say, well, you won in 2016, not 2020. And now they say, remember 2016 when Trump won. And I'm thinking to myself, when are you admitting that Donald Trump won? Kevin in Hampton Roads, Virginia. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, good morning, Brian. I'm calling in about the upcoming debate. I think that Kamala Harris is going to exceed expectations, and I think I give her the edge. And the, one of the reasons, first of all, her intelligence, I think, has been underestimated. She's a member of the California bar. I know a guy who took that. It's known as the most difficult bar exam.
Well, she failed the first time. Kevin, the only thing people – I don't want to get into smarter or not smart. I consider everybody else successful and smart, but she has not been strong – off script as vice president. Would you agree with that?
No, absolutely. And I think that for whatever reason, she was like that. But I think in this debate, I think she's going to try, as a lawyer, she's going to try to beat Trump with the nuances, kind of like Sugar Ray Leonard and the jab. She's going to continually jab at him with nuance.
Maybe. Possibly. But there's certain things like on the border and military, no nuance needed.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where 75% of the crimes are committed by illegal aliens. I am Brian Kilmeade. Happy to be coming to you this hour. Dr. Marcus Callen will be joining us at the bottom of the hour, best-selling author of the book For the Culture, The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. That's a big swath. And Mark Thiessen standing by. He asked me to buy some time. He's still in the shower. So let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The Justice Department is seizing 32 internet domains that the Russian government and the Russian-sponsored actors have used to engage in a covert campaign to interfere and influence the outcome of our country's elections.
Well, okay, there you go. Here we go again. Russia's already interfering in our election, according to Merrick Garland, the FBI taking action. But is it real or a distraction? We examine.
Number two.
Jerusalem Post is reporting that you're 90% there in negotiations with Hamas towards a ceasefire deal. Would you say that's accurate?
No, it's exactly inaccurate.
I just interviewed Prime Minister Netanyahu on the latest ceasefire deal negotiations. You will hear more momentarily, and I'll explain why it's in everyone's interest for him to stand strong and remain tough on the Gaza-Egypt border.
Number one.
So here's the detail. If you earn $1 million a year or more, the tax rate on your long-term capital gains will be 28% under my plan.
Fantastic. Jack up my rates, why don't you? Tracking the trail. Trump in New York giving a major economic speech while Harris starts debate camp. We review the rules of next week's face-off as the VP tries to separate herself from beloved Biden, whose approval ratings are going up. Mark Thiessen joins us now, Washington Post columnist and Fox News contributor. Mark, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Hey, first off, your reaction to the Russians influencing our election. Do you doubt it? Do you blame America if they're a little skeptical on that presser yesterday?
Well, first of all, this is coming from the same Justice Department that has completely politicized, the attacks on Donald Trump. And, you know, we just heard, you know, this is the same people who told us 51 intelligence officers told us that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation. So I don't blame Americans if they don't believe it. But I'll tell you who took Russian election interference seriously and who did something about it was Donald Trump. So I interviewed Trump in 2020, and I broke the story and got him to confirm that in 2018 he launched a cyber attack on Russia. He launched a cyber attack that took out the Internet Research Agency, which was the St. Petersburg troll farm that was interfering in the 2016 election and was doing it again, and he took them out. He just wiped their servers clean and knocked them off the Internet. And he didn't put out a press release about it. He didn't announce it. It was a covert action. It was actually a bold action. It was an act of war. It was, you know, he and Zelensky are the only two presidents in the world who have actually attacked Russia and in Russian territory. Right. And he took them out. And so, you know, here we were, forget the Russia stuff, because the Russians are obviously, what they're doing is they're trying to undermine support for Western support for Ukraine. So it's not just, if you look at it, Carrie Kupik Urban was on the air yesterday, and she pointed out, they said they're not interfering in the U.S., they're interfering across the world and countries across the world because they're trying to undermine support for Ukraine. I get that. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that there's been cyber attacks on the Trump campaign by the Iranians, who clearly do not want Donald Trump to win and would probably prefer to have Joe Biden win because he killed Qasem Soleimani. So why has Biden launched a cyber attack on Iran? Has he taken out the people who are hacking Donald Trump's campaign?
No.
You know, I'd like to see what action they are taking. Donald Trump literally launched a cyber attack on Russia. What has Joe Biden done with Iran?
So that is nothing, by the way. And I would love to see a big investigation into Iran's support of these protesters in and around these Ivy League schools and in New York City schools like City College. No one's talking about what's happening at City College, where Jewish students were just having lunch at a kosher diner, a kosher deli, and they were harassed and threatened. And this is one day, the school had been up one day. By the way, Vladimir Putin has made it clear he really likes Kamala Harris. He says the Kremlin backs Kamala, apparently, because of her infectious laugh. So he is having fun with our obsession. Here's what she says. So she laughs so expressively and infectiously. That means that everything is fine with her, Mr. Putin said with a smile before suggesting this could mean she would refrain from further sanctions against Russia. I doubt it. Who knows what she would do? She doesn't know what she would do. But obviously, Vladimir Putin's having fun with this. Listen to what our own David Spunt asked Merrick Garland. I think it's kind of telling. Cut 26.
Russia today sent a statement to Fox News and some other outlets here mocking the situation. They had five bullet points or six bullet points. The first said, ha, 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 ha. 2016 wants its cliches back. In all seriousness, there is a subsection of the country that when they hear Russian interference, they may believe that it's not true. It's not a real thing. How do you assure people this is a real situation?
I'm sure that was much funnier in the original Russian, but for us, it's not funny. This is deadly serious, and we are going to treat it accordingly.
Right. $10 million scheme, they say, to fund and direct a Tennessee-based company to publish and disseminate information favorable to the Russian government. The content was consistent with Russia's goal to push U.S. divisions and anti-Ukraine content. So Russia's having fun with the fact that they were overcharged in 2016. They brought $1 million worth of Facebook ads and tried to do more, but they didn't. And next thing you know, for the next 3.5 years under Trump, well, they were blamed for everything, and including collusion.
Yeah, I mean, look, what Russia's goal is, I mean, I don't know why Vladimir Putin would want Donald Trump to be elected, because he was the toughest president on Russia since Ronald Reagan. I mean, he launched a cyber attack on Russia. He ordered the U.S. military to kill hundreds of Wagner mercenaries in Syria. He got NATO to spend $400 billion more on defense. I mean, I could go down the list of things that he did. He was the first president to give lethal aid to Ukraine. He stopped the Nord Stream 2 pipeline until Joe Biden started it up again before the Ukraine war. I mean, he was the toughest president on Russia we've had since Reagan. So, right. You know, what Putin wants is he wants to sow divisions. He wants to undermine trust in our democracy. He wants to undermine support for Ukraine. He is definitely, I mean, there are people in the, particularly in the Republican Party in Congress, who are spouting Russian disinformation when it comes to Ukraine. There are info ops that are working, but it's not to help Donald Trump get elected. It's to undermine support for U.S. support for Ukraine, and that's what his foreign policy objective is.
I want you to hear what Liz Cheney said yesterday. You know, she's a conservative, former on leadership in the House. Said, "I don't believe we have the luxury of writing in candidates, names, particularly in swing states. As a conservative, as someone who believes and cares about the Constitution, I thought that deeply about this. And because of the danger that Donald Trump poses, not only am I not voting for him, I'll be voting for Kamala Harris." Does that do damage?
Yeah, she's not a conservative. It doesn't do damage. I think I can count on one hand the number of people who care about what Liz Cheney thinks about Donald Trump. It's obvious. I have lots of friends who are not voting for Donald Trump who are conservatives, and they just say, you know, pox on both their houses, I'm just out. You know, I'm not voting for him, I'm not voting for her. I respect that. I understand that. What I don't respect and understand is someone who claims to be a conservative and is voting for someone who has endorsed the entire Democratic Socialist agenda, from Green New Deal to Medicare for All, who wants to get rid of the filibuster so they can pack the Supreme Court and undo all the progress we've made. There's no benign alternative. If you are voting for Kamala Harris, I'm sorry, you're not a conservative.
Understood.
You're just not.
Yeah, no, I understand. So we know the President of the United States got 6 days to prepare for a debate. We know some of the rules. We know it's going to be 90 minutes. We know two commercial breaks. No opening statements, but there'll be closing statements. Candidates' microphones will be muted while the other one is speaking. No props, no pre-written notes are allowed on stage. The candidates will stand. There'll be two-minute rebuttals and one extra minute for follow-ups, clarifications, or responses. Campaign staff can meet with their candidate in the middle. They're just going to have to let them go. It's very similar, no audience. Seems like the Biden rules. What do you expect to happen? I know what you want to happen, but what do you think will happen?
So these are the Biden rules, the Biden-Harris rules, by the way, that she's been trying to get rid of. These were their demands, and Trump just said, "I'll meet anywhere, any place, anytime," and he accepted whatever their rules were. And now they wanted to change them because she wants, for whatever reasons, she can't stand for 90 minutes or whatever the heck it is. She, during that interview with CNN, she was asked the most simple, obvious question: what would you do on day one as president? And she didn't have an answer. I mean, this is not a woman who can think on her feet. How have you not prepared to answer that question?
I know.
As a candidate for president. So Democrats should be pretty worried about her ability to think on her feet, because that interview was much more of a disaster than the media has portrayed it. Donald Trump has to go in thinking one thing. His base is behind him. He does not need to pour any more gasoline on that fire. MAGA voters are going to walk over hot lava to vote for him. This election is going to come down to a few tens of thousands of voters in a handful of swing states, and every answer, everything he does in that debate should be focused on convincing those people who think the country's headed in the wrong direction but aren't sure about putting him back in the Oval Office, convincing them to vote for him, assuaging their concerns, giving them permission to vote in their self-interest. That means he's got, you know, he should not, you know, you know what the nickname he should use for Kamala during the debate is? It's not Comrade Kamala. It's Madam Vice President. That's the nickname she's running from, because she's the first sitting vice president in history who's had the audacity to try and run as an outsider.
It's crazy.
It's insane. And make him the incumbent. She's been in power for 4 years, so call her the vice president every time. Say, I know you don't want people to remind people that you're the vice president, but you've been in the White House for 4 years. You cast the deciding vote on the spending that unleashed the inflation. You were the border czar who unleashed the worst border disaster in American history. So with all respect, I'm going to call you by your title, Madam Vice President. You know, that's the nickname she doesn't want. Mm-hmm. She doesn't care about Comrade Kamala. And and prosecute that case. Make the case that she's responsible for all the things that are going wrong in your life, and were you better off under me than you are now?
You were the last one in the room in Afghanistan. Remember it. By the way, you know she wasn't. By the way, she answered it. But were you? Yes, I was. I think it's going to be great. So Robert Kennedy Jr. was asked, now that he's a consultant with Trump, and they are friends, what would you ask? Well, how would you steer the Kamala Harris debate if it was you? Cut 16.
I'd talk about her record. I'd talk about the border. I would, you know, if between 7 and as high as 15 million illegal immigrants who've come in, escorted in by the Sinaloa drug cartel. They've been crushing the social safety system in our country. I'd talk about the COVID lockdowns, which closed 3.3 million businesses, and 41% of the black-owned businesses will never reopen. It shifted $4.3 trillion north to from the American middle class to this new oligarchy of billionaires. I would talk about censorship. I think she's very, very vulnerable on that because of the statements that she's made, but also the policy of the Biden administration.
Same statement she's made. Remember, she wanted to suspend Donald Trump's account in 2019. This is when she was running for president. She wants to suspend his account. And now I guess she's in support of X getting stomped out in Brazil. And Zuckerberg came clean and said, I was pressured by the Biden administration when it comes to COVID. And we already know he's already said he was pressured when it came to the last election, 2020 election. So she's very vulnerable on that, unless she's going to say, I don't know, I had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, no, she's enormously vulnerable. And what she's going to do is she's going to try and bait Donald Trump into talking about January 6th. And, you know, don't take the bait. Say on January 6th, the border was secure, the world was at peace, inflation was low. That's what most Americans remember about January 6th. And you've ruined all of that. And the bigger threat to democracy, the biggest threat we face to democracy is that you're going to come into power, get rid of the filibuster, pack the Senate, add D.C. as a state, pack the Supreme Court, and pass your radical Green New Deal and Medicare for All and all the things you supported by simple majority vote. That's the threat to our democracy. Don't engage on her terms. If you're talking about January 6th, you're losing. If you're talking about pardoning people in January 6th, which is what she wants you to do, you're losing. Pivot immediately. Talk about her and her record. And two things, Brian. Remind people what they liked about you, the swing voters, which is your policies and how well they were doing under you. Don't remind them of the things they don't like about you, which are the insults and the behavior. You know, if you can do that, then you're going to win. You're going to look. He knocked out Biden in a single debate. He could do the same with Kamala Harris.
It sounds like you're sending Donald Trump to college. This is, sounds like the pep talk you give right before you send your kid to school. Remind people of the good things about you. Don't bring up your attitude that you had around the house. All right.
You know,
that's very good advice. And I know you'll probably give it to him. He's going to call you.
I have occasional conversations with him. He did a great job in the last debate. He was close to pitch perfect. He just needs to come in with the same attitude, not think because it's a different candidate he doesn't need to let her. You know, she has the same problem constructing sentences, just without the excuse of age. Let her talk.
Right. I agree. And hey, who knows? Maybe the Democrats put a third candidate if she gets knocked out. Bring in Governor Shapiro.
Can you imagine
next.
The panic if she has a meltdown during the debate?
And that would break your heart. It would really break your heart.
It would. I'd be very sad for America. You're right.
Right. Mark Thiessen, thanks so much.
Take care.
Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
What's the reason for the sit-in in Hillary Clinton's class?
Again, I can't say for sure because I'm not affiliated with the people who are organizing the sit-in, but I'll say that Hillary Clinton is a war criminal, and war criminals deserve no peace until they, you know, repair the damage they've done to the world, and that includes Hillary Clinton.
Right, repair the damage. We don't know why. Or what she does, but we know she's a war criminal. In this case, Hillary Clinton's 100% right to stand up for what she believes as a professor at Columbia. She says the Palestinians have walked away from every legitimate chance they had at a two-state solution. She was there with her husband, there as Secretary of State, has that opinion. And the answer with Columbia is she's a war criminal and a genocidal maniac. Dr. Marcus Collins joins us now. Best-selling author of... Oh, okay. He's going to be with us in a few minutes. But he's going to be doing. He's going to be talking about the culture and the power behind what we buy, what we do, and who we want to be, and overcoming people that say things like that is what you got to deal with, and somehow get them to vote for you. That's how blended everything is now when it comes to Republicans and Democrats, men and women. especially when it comes to the Palestinian situation as it relates to Michigan. Patrick in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Good.
Brian, what's your opinion on this? You know, where I work, 98% of the employees happen to be African-American, and they listen to, you know, CNN, MSNBC, and when I tell them about the debate when Democrat Tulsi Gabbard took down you know,
show it to them.
Yeah, show it to them. Show them that, you know, that how when she was AG, when she put African Americans and, you know, Hispanics behind bars just because of a little bit of weed they were caught with, but yet she laughed about it when she was on the radio. And then when she thinks that, you know, if you're 18 to 24 years of age, that, you know, she thinks you're stupid.
I know. Back in a moment.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Brian Kilmeade is back with you right here in studio, 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. With me in studio is Dr. Marcus Collins. He's a best-selling author of For the Culture, The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. It's available in paperback now, and it's also important to know that you actually have action wear for your book.
Yes.
I mean, it says For the Culture, a pullover sweatshirt. I'm so jealous.
I'm a marketer, man. This is what we do.
Right.
Think about all the many ways by which we go to market beyond just the product.
Right. So tell us how this plays, your beliefs play into this election.
Sure.
That people are smart.
Sure. You know, well, I believe, you know, anytime we put candidates on stage, we are going to market, right? We are marketing. We are bringing our candidates to market in hopes of getting people to cast their vote. Just like a company would bring their product to market to in hopes that you will pay money. We are constantly trying to get people to move. And what I believe is that in this election in particular, is that people will be voting based upon their ideological subscription, more so than about like my connection with the candidate. For instance, you know, back in the day, I think the Bush days, it was like, I want to get a beer with that guy. I'm going to vote for that guy. I don't know his policies that well, but I feel like he's still likable, right? Just like JFK and Nixon. It's like, that guy has a cold. That's not my guy. It's that guy who looks more proper. But I feel like we're at a time in society where ideologically, that's what drives how we think about the political zeitgeist. And there's so much division in the world because of our ideological incongruence, that's what's going to lead the day today, I think.
So, but don't you think things have changed even from 2020? I mean, a lot of the things that Kamala Harris was standing for in 2020 that she was running for against other Democrats, she's like, yeah, I'm not for that anymore. Whether it was getting rid of fossil fuels, whether it was we even found her talking to Al Sharpton about reparations. She was talking about decriminalizing border crossings, mm-hmm. giving health care for illegals.
Sure.
She knows that doesn't fly for either side in this culture, correct?
Yeah.
And if she held to that, she might get blown out.
Yeah. Well, you know,
like Barry Goldwater got blown out. He was sort of set of beliefs. America was not there in 60,
yeah.
64.
You know, I think of it this way. I think that there are some policy issues that can evolve over time. There's some ideological things that evolve slowly, right? So policy issues that I stood for this or I believed in this 5 years ago. But you know what? As I think about it more, as the zeitgeist shifts, my perspective changes. Here's a crude example. I grew up listening to or loving stand-up comedy. Like, I loved Eddie Murphy as a kid. Loved, loved, loved him. Eddie Murphy's Raw and Delirious comes back on comes on Netflix, and I'm like, I'm so excited to watch this. I'm like reliving my childhood. I watch it, and I'm clutching my pearls the entire time. The so-called
political incorrectness.
Yeah, the movie, the show, the stand-up hadn't changed over those years, but I had, right? And I think the same thing kind of goes when we think about policy issues, that my stance on a thing can shift as more information comes in. But what I believe, how I see the world, those things I feel are far more permanent, and those things, they move less quickly. Therefore, I'm more likely to find the person I'm most ideologically aligned with to say, that's my guy or that's my woman.
And it's okay. So give me an idea. So if it's not policy, because you think that's going to evolve quickly and change quickly, what do you think about the culture right now? What is going to be polarizing in the culture right now, or might be something a candidate should be aware of if they want to get that vote?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the fact that you call it that, the culture right now, Culture is built on identity and beliefs, right? I believe this, and therefore I'm going to find the person who sees the world most like I do. We see, you know, a hotbed conversation right now is around women's bodily autonomy. That's an ideological thing. There are policies that come out of that ideological topic, but it's the beliefs around that that's going to guide where people set
their
shares.
Even the way you said that's different, because up until 5 years ago, pro-life, pro-choice.
Yeah, exactly.
So what did you just say?
Exactly. Bodily autonomy.
Right.
Right. Again, so perfectly said, right? Pro-life, pro-choice, that is about policy. They are informed by ideals, but they're policy driven. Bodily autonomy is all conceptual. I believe that women should have the right to choose what they do with their bodies, right? That belief system then informs the kind of policy that I would follow. But in most cases, in today, for sure, people are like, I just want to go where the beliefs are. And I think that we're actually kind of wired for that. I mean, we think about what is culture? Culture is a system of conventions and expectations that demarcate who we are and govern what people like us do, right? I am A, we believe this, therefore I. As we look at the political zeitgeist, we find ourselves having much of our division based upon how we see the world, our ideological subscription. Therefore, we're going to say, who are the candidates that are most like me, not in identity, but in belief system, and that's where I'm going to point myself.
Where does practicality come in? For example, if I'm not safe at home, if I can't afford to shop the way I used to, I'm angry, and I want that person that's going to bring me back the security and the financial stability.
Yeah.
Well, how does that figure into what you said?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the beautiful part in all of this, that there are empirical proof points that say the economy is doing well. But then people go, I ain't feeling that. I know it's not going well for me. I don't feel it that way. Well, you go, well, objectively, it is.
Unemployment's low. Market's up.
Exactly. But the truth of the matter is, which I think is kind of what my work centers on, is that there is no objectivity. Everything is subjective. That's why for some, a cow is leather. For others, a deity. For some, it's dinner. Which one is it? It's all those things, depending on who you are and how you see the world. For some, a rug is decor. For others, a souvenir. And for some, it's a place of worship. Which one is it? It's all those things, depending on who you are. So we talk about, we ask questions like, well, what about safety? And what about economic security? And I go, well, some look at those numbers and say, well, I don't see it that way. And others do, based on how we see the world. So looking at the voter based, not based on the labels we put on them, Democrat, Republican, Independent, but belief systems, I think it opens, widens the aperture and gives us a better understanding of where people actually place their votes.
So where's America now? You say, well, we are separate in some ways. So what do you think the things matter to the average American now?
I think that there are hotbed issues right there.
You mentioned about reproductive rights.
Reproductive rights. There's, you know, I want to be able to care for my family. I want to have like some stability in my health. I want to make sure that my kids can go to school and they're going to come back safe. They're these sort of primal things.
Did you see the shooting yesterday in Georgia?
Exactly. Exactly. So because of that belief system, I will then point to a policy that aligns most with the ideal on whether or not people should have access to guns with any kind of regulation or not. Right. So, again, anchored in identity or anchored in ideology and then manifested through policy. I think that we are in a state as a country that the culture wars that we're living in, it is a byproduct of our misunderstanding of what culture is and how we navigate through it. By that, I mean culture is a system of conventions and expectations that takes things that are messy, that are abstract, that are noisy, that are nonsense, and we give it meaning based on how we see the world, right? And if we understood culture that way, that is not – the world is not objective, it's subjective, then I could say, oh, Brian, your truth is different than my truth.
I'll give you the best example.
Yeah.
Mayor of Chicago.
Yep.
Mayor of Chicago comes out and he sees these young kids, minority kids, raiding a section, a really nice area of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, this has got to stop. You got to provide security.
Yep.
He says, well, we got to find something for these kids to do.
Yeah.
One say, I just want security. I don't care why they're here.
That's right.
Wrong. You can't go rob a store because you don't have a gym to play in.
That's right. Yeah.
But he goes, look, no, we gotta do better by these kids. They have no outlet. They're single parent families.
That's right.
So same problem, Different perspective.
Exactly. I mean, so the beautiful part of this is that your truth can be different than my truth, can be opposed to my truth.
But same facts.
But exactly. We're looking at the same thing empirically, but we're translating it differently. And so long as your truth doesn't mean my oppression, doesn't mean my marginalization, we can actually work together.
Right.
And that's like the beautiful part. That is the diversity bonus as it is, that you get different perspectives in a room and we look at a problem from different sides and go, what's the best solution?
Do you think anyone could get elected by saying both sides, hey, yeah, I saw what happened over in the smash and grab over in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I saw what happened over there and I see one side come out and say, that's the problem. Minority kids are America's inherently racist.
Yeah.
And for minority kids, they don't have the same opportunity as white kids. That's why white kids aren't there. And then you could look at this and say, and the other people say, are you kidding me? We just need more cops.
Yeah.
So do you think a candidate could ever get elected by saying both are right and both are wrong?
I think.
And I could go in there and let's fix it.
So I think that a candidate can if they're brave enough to preach that gospel and not to say I'm going to both sides this thing. I'm trying to play to both sides, but I'm trying to communicate a point of view that I have. And when they say it out loud, someone goes, yeah, I totally. Yes. But you know what? Why can't it be both sides?
Right.
And what happens is that you activate a group of people who see the world the way you do, and then they go evangelize on your behalf. Because the truth of the matter is that most candidates that we rally around, it's not because we heard a talk and said, yep, that's it. We heard a talk and go, that's interesting. And then we go to dinner, you and I, and you go, did you hear that talk about whatever? I go, that was kind of cool, right? You go, totally, it was cool. And collectively, we decide that it's acceptable.
Right.
And we do that at dinner. We do that at the bar. We do that at our congregations, at church. We do that at work. And constantly, we sort of create these coalitions of shared ideologies. And we gather together and we place our votes accordingly.
But what blows up the system is if you tell me, if I'm a candidate and I tell you what you want to hear and I know it, but I don't plan on doing it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. So that's why people's why. Why do you believe that I am going to crack down on crime? Why do you believe that the environment should be number one? Why do you believe
that
fossil fuel is being underappreciated and can be done cleaner? So rather than just tell me what I want to believe.
Instead of telling me the policy points, tell me what you believe, how you see the world.
People get really bitter. I'll give you an example. The most common, Joe Biden came out and said, hey, you know, I'm going to be a moderate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be a moderate. And then people say, okay, you're going to be a moderate. But no, he was pretty much, I looked at it as way to the left. So that's different. So people feel, wow, I feel duped.
Sure.
So I'm going to vote for him. Some people, I'm going to vote for him now. I'm going to vote for Trump regardless. But the people in the middle that go, up until the end, you know what? He was going to bring normalcy back. He was going to get rid of the polarization. Well, we're even more divided than ever before. And this Inflation Reduction Act had more green policies, had nothing to do with inflation. In fact, you actually told us at the end it had nothing to do with inflation.
Mm-hmm.
It was mislabeled. That, I think, creates more bitterness than, by the way, when I get in the economy, it's going to be the new Green Deal.
Yeah.
You voted for me. Even if I win 49-48, I won.
Yeah.
And this I told you I'm going to do.
Yeah.
But don't go do something opposite from what you said because it makes people feel taken advantage of.
I think the point you're making is that there are promises told and the promises that are not kept. Or at the very least, there's intentionality that's communicated, but it doesn't seem to be manifested.
Right. And people understand not reaching your goals.
Yes.
That's called life.
That's right.
But you got to try.
That's right. And we know, here's the thing, that our understanding as a society of politics, of government in particular, it's pretty shallow.
Yeah.
We go, you're president, make it happen.
Right.
And you go, dude, do you know how many coalitions that I have to create to actually get a thing through the door? Those things are very difficult. And explaining that in, you know, is better than most. Explaining that in 48 minutes with commercial breaks.
You can't
blame
the president, no matter who it is, what's going wrong or right in your life.
There's so much nuance there. It makes it very difficult to communicate it. So therefore, it's easy to place blame on what happens as opposed to thinking about intentionality and ideology.
A few more minutes with Dr. Marcus Collins. His book is out now, paperback, for the culture, the power behind what we buy, what we do, and who we want to be. Back in a moment.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So Dr. Marcus Collins is here. His book, For the Culture, is out now on paperback, The Power Behind What We Buy, What We Do, and Who We Want to Be. So, Dr. Collins, I think that Kamala Harris seems to be doing what you're doing. Because you know what we're seeing? We're seeing speeches, and then we see, like, TikTok videos of her. Let me tell you the secret to my recipe. Let me tell you this. Let me show you with my family. They're selling a product rather than selling issues, right? Here's my economy. You know, Warren Harding, this is what I like. You know, there was no charisma like Teddy Roosevelt had charisma. So she's trying to sell her as a personality. In this short, bifurcated race, could that work?
Well, I think so. I think we've seen it done in 2008 with Barack Obama. We saw it in 2016 with Donald Trump. And we've seen it now with Kamala Harris. I mean, essentially, they're communicating a point of view, how we see the world, right? For Barack Obama, the idea was that we don't have a problem with legislation. We don't have a problem with ideas. We have a problem with cynicism. People believe the government is broken. So what did he run on? Hope. Together we can. And people said, yes, I see the world that way. That's my guy. 8 years later, 8 years later, Donald Trump comes and says, well, you know what? We feel like we've kind of gone away from our traditions. We've gone away from sort of what the ethos of America. Let's go back to a time when things were a certain way. And what do you say? Let's make America great again. People said, yes, that's my guy. Kamala Harris is saying, well, you know what? We actually need to be going forward, making the progress as a country, because that's what America is all about. We choose to go to the moon, right? We're moving forward. And so she's saying, you know, freedom is the way by which we do that. Freedom, not going backwards, going forwards. So people go, that's the person for me. It's ideologies that we find ourselves gravitating towards more so than the value propositions that manifest through policy.
And I understand that. But do you think also part of the reason that Barack Obama won is because when the economy collapsed, he went to school with Hank Paulson, a Republican Treasury Secretary, to say, how do we fix this? So he made people not only feel good that he can speak on his feet, but he's like, well, let me just tell you what I found out, what we're going to have to do. This TARP thing is not political. It's got to work. This is what we're going to have to do with the auto companies. He actually had a plan. Right. And same with Trump goes, I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do. And Biden says, I'm going to show you what normal looks like. And then Harris at one point has got to say, looking forward. Now, what does that mean and what changed? At one point, Steele's got to go against Steele.
Sure. I would say, if we're just being totally honest with each other, if you polled people on the street in 2007, 2008 and said, what's Barack Obama's policy? You get a lot of blank stares. I imagine if we did the exact same thing with Donald Trump, you probably get sound bites. Memes.
Well, you get wall.
Build the wall, right? You're like, well, why? What does that mean? I mean, we've seen TikTok videos of this. We've seen videos of this. Like, people don't know it. They clump onto language to justify a belief. I mean, the same thing here. I don't think that people are voting on policy. One would say we're voting on vibes, but vibes are important. Right. Vibes are the instinct that we lead with because of what we feel. We aren't rational human beings. We're rationalizing human beings.
Dr. Marcus Collins, our guest. Dr. Collins, now, what is the recipe for America to sell itself on on the year 2026? It's our 250th birthday. How can a nation rally around that the way they did in 1776? I mean, in 1976.
It's exactly what we're saying today. We have to put
it. It's an opportunity, isn't it?
It's an opportunity to say, hey, what do we believe, y'all? Like, you see it should be manifested a different way than I do, but we share the same beliefs. We want the same things. The work that we're doing with Suzy, this is a consumer insights company. The work we're doing with Suzy, we're realizing that while we talk to people who identify as Republicans, Democrats, independents, they want the same things. Just the manner in which they go about getting them differ. And those differences are important, but at the core, we want the same things. And that's the ethos of this country that we all want.
So get the so secure the foundation.
Yes.
Got a year to do it.
And this is, so I think of it this way. When I work with brands like Nike, right? Nike doesn't talk about the leather that it makes or how it produces the shoes. It talks about every human body is an athlete. And the idea there is pushed there.
Right. Just do it. Pick up for the culture. Thanks, Dr. Collins.
Thanks for having me.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here, coming your way from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. This hour, we're going to be talking to Congressman D. Esposito. He's with the Homeland Security Committee, but he's right here. The New York congressman is in a tough battle Literally, seats like his in New York and California will decide the balance of power in the House. He's going to be with us shortly. Also, I got to get his perspective on law and order in New York. They keep telling us crime is down. 75% of all the crime committed in New York City, right in Midtown, is from illegal immigrants. We have about 70,000 here illegally, and now we're paying them $4,000 if they just move out of the shelters. This is a problem that New York is solely responsible for. It's their policies that illegals are taking advantage of. Before we get to my next guest, Zoe Marks, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The Justice Department is seizing 32 internet domains that the Russian government and the Russian-sponsored actors have used to engage in a covert campaign to interfere and influence the outcome of our country's elections.
All right, here we go again. Russia's already interfering in our election. The FBI is taking action, but is this all a distraction? We'll discuss it.
Number two.
Jerusalem Post is reporting that you're 90% there in negotiations with Hamas towards a ceasefire deal. Would you say that's accurate?
No, it's exactly inaccurate.
I just interviewed the Prime Minister of Israel on the latest ceasefire negotiations. You'll hear more momentarily. I'll explain why it's in everyone's interest for him to stand strong and remain on the Gaza-Egypt border. We'll discuss it.
Number one.
So here's the detail. If you earn $1 million a year or more, the tax rate on your long-term capital gains will be 28% under my plan.
There you go. Kamala Harris, yesterday in New Hampshire, decides to lay out some principles of an economic policies under her, different from under Joe. It's going to cost you a lot of money. Tracking the trail. Trump in New York, giving a major economic speech himself. Harris starts debate camp. We'll discuss it. But Zoe joins us now. She's director of overseas operations of YATAR, which is an acronym. It's a counterterrorism unit. She served in the IDF from 2018 to 2021, and an active reservist who served with distinction in the past. But great to have you in studio here in New York.
Thank you so much for having me today, Brian.
So what is it? When's the last time you were in Israel?
So I was in Israel about 4 months ago. That was the last time I was there. Yes.
Did you grow up there?
Yes, I was born and raised in Israel. My whole family was.
How different does it feel today?
Unfortunately, it's shifted completely, the entire environment in Israel. Since the attack of October 7th, everyone has been affected by it. It's been a feeling in the air. It's been people, you know, losing family, losing friends. It's touched every single one of us in all ages and all different groups, and everyone is truly affected by it. Till today, 11 months later, and it hasn't stopped since.
You said your brother's going back?
Yes, one of my brothers, he's a reservist as well. He's 31 years old, and he's going back now for the third time.
How has he described the fighting?
I think, from my personal knowledge and experience and my unit and my brother, the fighting inside, everyone is very focused and very dedicated to the mission. Of course, it's unfortunate that these soldiers, these reservists, haven't seen their families, their children, haven't been to their jobs properly in the last 11 months. But everyone is very focused and dedicated to doing what we can to protect our country, to save the lives of our people out there, and just fulfill the mission that we're placed in.
So I talked to the Prime Minister today, 2 hours ago, and you heard a little about what he said. Here's more when asked, is the ceasefire close?
Jerusalem Post is reporting that you're 90% there in negotiations with Hamas towards a ceasefire deal. Would you say that's accurate?
No, it's exactly inaccurate. There's a story, a narrative out there that there's a deal out there. In fact, while we agreed in May and July and in August to a deal and to an American proposal, Hamas has consistently said no to every one of them. They don't agree to anything, not to the Philadelphia corridor, not to the keys of exchanging hostages for jail terrorists, not to anything. So that's just a false narrative. They just want us out of Gaza so they can retake Gaza. No, the report that there's a deal out there and that the only thing holding it up is the Philadelphia tunnel is not merely not true. It's just a direct falsehood.
Philadelphia corridor, which is 9 miles long, which separates Gaza from Egypt, huge tunnels there that have tractor trailers going down beneath Gaza, and we see 500 square miles of tunnels. How do you feel about his statement?
I think that when it comes to this aspect, our leaders, they're the ones who are the decision makers. Us, the soldiers, the reservists out on the field, we follow the mission to where we need to be in order to, again, protect our borders, protect our country, and save lives. So we leave that to the decision makers, and we know that we follow the commands that we're given.
Were you stunned to hear about the sophistication of the tunnels underneath Gaza and the how many are located at that Gaza border?
I think it was stunning to everyone, but this is something that also Israel has known about for several years, and we've been fighting constantly against this threat.
Rockets, yes. But yes. I didn't think the tunnels to this degree. Did you?
No.
And why is it make it really hard to fight? And I understand one of the things tactically that you guys are doing is not necessarily going into tunnels to fight them, bringing them up. Is that a correct, is that the tactic as you understand it?
So I, from our unit in Yatar, how we operate, I'll take you back to that a second, is that we use these ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, in these different roles in the war efforts. And part of what we do is we work over ground and we operate with the different Israeli defense forces in order to, again, save the lives of our wounded and do what we can to protect. So the different tactical operations I cannot share about more, but at the end of the day, we are there to operate to save lives and bring our people home.
Right. I want you to hear more from my interview. Here's a little bit more.
What we have to do is to make sure that we do two things. One, get the hostages out. That's why I'm wearing this yellow pin. And second, keep the red lines that are necessary for Israel's security and survival. And I think both of them go through holding the Philadelphia corridor, because that presses Hamas. That prevents them from rearming. It prevents Gaza from becoming this Iranian terror enclave again, which can threaten our existence. But it's also the way to prevent them from smuggling hostages that they keep through the ceasefire into Egypt, into the Sinai, where they could disappear. And then they'll end up in Iran or in Yemen, and they're lost forever. So if you want to release the hostages, and you want to make sure that Gaza doesn't become pose a threat to Israel again, you've got to keep the Philadelphia corridor, which is the entry gate of Iran to Gaza, firmly in Israel's hands. And that's what we're really doing right now.
And that's what they're doing. But I understand the footage at about 7,000 people outside the prime minister's residence over the weekend after the execution of those six hostages, one of which was American. They tried to breach the perimeter. There seems to be a lot of anger in Tel Aviv, too.
I think when you see six hostages being executed, I can share that one of them, Almog Sarusi, he's one of my brother's childhood best friends.
Wow.
I think everyone is affected by this, so I'm sure a lot of people want just the hostages back. They all deserve to come back to their homes, and we're very thankful, us and our unit, and to all the forces that did rescue their bodies and bring them back to where they need to be.
So I want you to hear what's going on in New York City. I suppose, do you live here now?
I'm currently based here, yes.
Yeah, so do you know what's going on in Columbia City College?
I've seen.
So I want you to hear a little of what they're doing. Now they have a problem with Hillary Clinton, of all people. Listen to some of these protesters. Cut 22.
Is Palestine a top issue for you as a voter? Is it the issue?
Yes. I don't like the idea of the genocide being subsumed under electoralism and some kind of like political horse race. So my concern isn't really with the election, it's with the genocide. But that said, yes, I do think that the Democratic Party should take seriously the threat of people who normally would be their supporters withholding their vote over a red line issue, which for us is genocide.
Do you think she's characterizing it correctly, what's going on over there?
I don't think so, but I also know that, from the American perspective, we have been obviously heard a lot of these people talking about it. But I will say that we've also had a lot of fellow Americans supporting us and also bringing the awareness that is needed to these people who are not even familiar with the situation.
Right. I mean, it's almost as if they're naive. They just get a little bit of information and they think they understand what's going on. What do you understand what's going on in Gaza right now?
Again, I know that from the IDF's perspective and us in Yatar, in our unit specifically, we have a goal of bringing back the hostages and also rescuing all the wounded soldiers from the battlefield.
Do you go out? Is the IDF policy to avoid civilian casualties?
Absolutely.
Do you think Hamas has the same ideal?
No, I think that that we do in the IDF everything that is needed in order to protect civilian casualties. But we will also reach our enemies, whatever they may be.
Right. Do you think that that should be made more apparent around the world?
Definitely, absolutely. Just from this, these six hostages' bodies that were rescued a few days ago, IDF has shared with the public that the soldiers have found children's toys and drawings just by the tunnels where they were kept captive for the last 11 months. So we know that that's what Hamas is doing.
They also weren't being fed. One, the woman was 76 pounds.
Yes, and then Yerushalmi.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the conditions are absolutely awful. And just don't know how much longer, they can hold out, and knowing how much longer the Hamas can hold out. Do you believe, from what you know, just anecdotally, from what you've experienced, does Hamas speak for the Palestinian people, for the ones you know?
No, we know that Hamas puts the civilians in front of them so they'd get hurt before we reach them, and they use them. We've seen hospitals that were used, schools that were used, mosques that were used to cover up Hamas points, locations from where they were operating from.
Wow. I just want you to hear a little bit more. This is Hillary Clinton, Democrat, former Secretary of State, First Lady, was there every step of the way with Yasser Arafat and Ariel Sharon for a while, Shimon Peres, when they were trying to get the Oslo thing past Barack, Ehud Barak, when they were trying to get the Oslo deal done and get the Palestinians, maybe the West Bank and Gaza as a Palestinian state. So because of that, she really believes that the Palestinians have blown every opportunity. Because of that and those beliefs, she's now being protested. Listen to this. Cut 20.
What's the reason for the sit-in in Hillary Clinton's class?
Again, I can't say for sure because I'm not affiliated with the people who are organizing the sit-in, but I'll say that Hillary Clinton is a war criminal, and war criminals deserve no peace until they, repair the damage they've done to the world, and that includes Hillary Clinton.
You have a reaction to that?
At the end of the day, I think that I don't have a reaction to that specifically. I can share it with you that even then and even now, there's actually a great quote by Golda Meir, our past prime minister in Israel. And she said there will only be peace when they love their children more than they hate us. So we all know that that's the truth, and that's what we're aiming for.
Do you have friends that are Palestinians?
Not personally, no.
Not personally? Is there a big separation? If I go to a major city in Israel, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, is there a big separation between the two?
No, we have plenty of coexistence. We have equal rights for everyone in Israel, all of our citizens as one.
And you're under the belief that Iran is the fundamental problem behind all this?
We all know at the end of the day, a threat is a threat. Again, that's something that I don't know for sure. That's the decision makers who might know better than me. But we're facing a threat regardless for our existence. So we'll be there out there on the field every day operating to save our people.
When there's a draft, like men and women are drafted, what does that do to galvanize a country around a belief? And what does it do for patriotism, knowing that if you live in Israel, you will serve?
I think patriotism is unbelievable in Israel. Everyone, if you're born in Israel, you know that at the age of 18, you're going to be drafted to the IDF. So were my three older brothers, and so was myself. My parents moved from London to Israel knowing this fact that their children will have to do it. And I think we all do it with pride. Even now with thousands of reservists out in the field, people from the ages of 18 till 40s, 50s plus are serving with pride and doing everything we can. I can tell you that, again, us in Yatar, we're all reservists, and each one of our soldiers, man, woman, again, hasn't seen their family, friends, jobs for a long time, and we're doing what we can to save the lives of our people.
And you're a counterterrorism unit?
Yes.
Okay, and if people want to support, this is a private thing? This is not government-supported, or it is?
Let me explain again quickly that we are a volunteer unit of reservists working in collaboration with different IDF with different Israeli forces. And you can definitely see more about us through our website at yatarisrael.org. Wow. And You can see how we use these ATVs, these all-terrain vehicles, to extract the wounded soldiers from the battlefield, to rescue the lives of people, to protect all the borders of Israel. Our very tiny country is around the size of New Jersey, like we discussed off-air a minute ago. And we are working all along the borders in order to protect our country and our people.
Last question. How hard has it been in the north? Because I understand you had to move, what, 60,000 people out of there into a safer area because of the shelling from Hezbollah?
Yes. Since October 8th, there's been extreme threat from the north and increased activity. I have a friend whose family's economy relies on farms, on peach farms specifically, and they've had to evacuate, and one of the Hezbollah missiles fell on their farm and destroyed their entire income. It's been very difficult for the entire country, but we've been prepared since day one, since October 8th, after the breakout of the war of October 7th, in order to face every threat that we might have, and we're preparing for that as well, as long as all the threats that we still have in Judea and Samaria and all of our other borders.
And if you want to help out, it's YATAR, the Counterterrorism Unit, YATAR, and Zoe Marks, Director of Overseas Operations for YATAR. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Stay safe and best of luck to your family and friends.
Thank you so much. Friends. I appreciate
it. Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This is a stunning indictment, and it really shows potentially how deeply integrated Russia is with the MAGA media environment. This company that is described in Tennessee is a pretty well-known MAGA media company. It has on its payroll many of the top pro-Trump voices in this country, and they were knowingly conspiring with Russia, using millions of dollars to put content online and to pay a number of pro-Trump commentators that, have been pushing an anti-Harris and pro-Russia narrative for months.
Senator Murphy better be ready to back that up, because I have never heard that. Now you're saying Donald Trump, again, his people, anyway, cavorting with Russia in order to get this indictment, not mentioned by Merrick Garland, but known by Senator Chris Murphy. That's interesting. So blame Trump again for Russia meddling in our elections. By the way, they're not meddling with the actual elections. What they're doing is putting forth a narrative, 200 exhibits, a media company spending like $10 million in order to spread pro-Russia propaganda and suppress what they can for pro-Ukraine talk. So now all of a sudden, Senator Murphy's linking it to Russia. All right, fine. Should we link Democrat movements to Iran? Because they're out trying to kill Donald Trump and actually they cyber attacked his headquarters. Am I, should I just assume Democrats are behind that, working with Iran? I don't, but he did.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
If you actually believe everything in the indictment, and I read every word of it just now, this is really small ball stuff. There's no evidence that any Russian money changed anybody's opinion. They say in the indictment that two of the influencers that were targeted did not know that it was Russian money. There's no evidence that, like, really there was any serious amount of media coverage to influence anything measurable in terms of opinion. You know, all that being said, I mean, the main issue here is that we have this record of the Department of Justice running Russian disinformation hoaxes twice, not once. The first time claiming that the Russians favored Trump when we now know that they favored Clinton. And then the second time, the Hunter Biden laptop, where we now know that the FBI ran a disinformation effort to make people think that it was about the Russians.
Michael Schellenberger responding to the new indictments announced by the FBI director and the AG, Merrick Garland, talking about them spending $10 million, 200 exhibits, 60-plus pages, talking about what the Russians are up to again. And people are wondering, why you expect us to believe you now? Let's bring in Congressman Anthony D'Esposito of New York's 4th District. He's also on the Homeland Security Committee. Congressman, what is your reaction to Michael Schellenberger's assessment of what Merrick Garland announced yesterday?
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a sec, Brian, but obviously, you know, we're concerned, and I wasn't on for the leading in segment, so I didn't actually hear what you played.
What you have is Merrick Garland announcing yesterday that the Russians are again trying to manipulate our elections through information, not necessarily hacking. What Iran's doing is their cyber attacks. What he found Russia's doing is trying with disinformation, whether it's stay out of Ukraine or it is trying to foment some division here in America when it comes to voting. A lot of people don't feel as though there's credibility there.
I think it's things that we knew that these foreign adversaries are trying to interfere into our elections. It's something that we've gone over and over again with the Committee on House Administration, trying to make our elections more secure. And it's one of the things that the Democrats continue to turn the blind eye onto, is that our adversaries are trying to influence our elections in many different ways. And it's not just the ones that, so to speak, is the shiny objects. It's the things in our peripheral vision that we need to be focused on. And I think it's something that we need to make sure that we keep on. And I truly will say that over the last in the 118th Congress, the Committee on House Administration has taken giant steps, whether it was dealing with Zuckerbucks here locally or dealing with the influence of adversaries throughout the world.
I guess we'll see what happens. Congressman, a lot of people say your race and races like yours will decide the balance of power in the House. Are you under that belief?
I am. I think that we have races like we have on Long Island and across New York State, where you have quality candidates running in these tough districts. You take a district like mine, where Democrats outnumber us in registration by about 70,000, in a county where Democrats outnumber us by about 130,000. But Republicans remain strong. I mean, you have countywide, we have all 4 countywide seats are Republican, led by our county executive, Bruce Blakeman, and our DA, Annie Donnelly. The Republicans control the 3 towns in Nassau County, Oyster Bay, Hempstead, and North Hempstead, and both cities in the city of Long Beach and Glen Cove. And I think what's important is that a couple of those places, like Long Beach, which is in the south part of my district, you know, it is historically been a Democratic stronghold, and we've worked to focus on issues that are important right here locally, as well as the issues that that matter globally. But you take that approach that everything matters, that you focus on the small stuff, and that's why we're taking these seats and flipping them from blue to red.
You know, what's interesting is crime's an issue. They keep saying crime's going down, but in New York, in Midtown, where I'm at right now, they say 75% of the crime is under these illegal immigrants. I know in school systems, now you have these illegal immigrants who turn up in states like New York, and all of a sudden they don't speak English. They pop up in third, fourth grade. They're probably fine kids. But now all the special services that taxpayers are paying for go to these kids that really shouldn't be here. Have you found that in your district? Is this a complaint among parents?
Absolutely. And it's not something that's new. I would say probably over a year ago, I met with different superintendents and school board members from throughout the district. And there was parts of the district where you wouldn't expect this to be an issue. But I think that we're seeing that it's actually plaguing every part of Long Island and New York, where, you know, school board members are elected, they don't get paid, and they truly do their best to provide the best services to the communities that they represent at the lowest cost. And when you have in the middle of a school year an influx of 4, 5, 6 or more kids where English is the second language, and you're right, the resources are now going to these kids, you don't have the funding in order to keep up with the budget. And the children whose parents are paying, you know, especially on Long Island, and some pretty good fair share of school taxes, they are not getting the education that they deserve, because unfortunately, these teachers who are doing the best that they can with what they have to put resources to these children who are learning English as a second language.
There's two things that people say that Nassau County is running a mini Trump campaign. Number one, with the masks. If it's now illegal to wear a mask in New York State. Twice, they've cracked down on people with masks. It turns out one had a record, one was committing a crime. And number two, they said it's so basically illegal, not allowed to have a trans athlete play in women's sports and vice versa. How has that worked?
So I don't think that it's a Trump campaign. I think it's the fact that we're doing the right thing. I think that individuals like myself and our county executive, Bruce Blakeman, have focused on what when we talk to neighbors and we go out there every single day and the things that people are talking about at their dinner tables are exactly this. They're concerned. Parents are concerned that their children are going to play in sports and their little girls are going to have to play against boys. I mean, I think it's pretty common sense. It's pretty logical that girls should play in girls' sports and boys should play in boys' sports. And when it comes to the masks, yeah, I mean, my district is probably the most Jewish district in the country. But this isn't just about anti-Semitism. It's not just about hate. It's about the fact that people are utilizing masks in order to commit crimes. And just last week, we saw this, come to our point that someone was arrested for wearing a mask and they were in the process of committing a crime. And there have, you know, there's exceptions in the law. If it's health, if it's religious reasons, there's exceptions there. This is about focusing on bad actors who are committing crimes against people in Nassau County. And we are making a stand that we will not tolerate it.
And so here in Manhattan and around the country, we're seeing again the pro Hamas protests pick up right where they left off in the spring. Listen to some of these activists with our Alexis McAdams yesterday. Cut 23.
Do you think Columbia handled things well, and do you think it's going to be any better this year?
Well, Columbia has been downright consistent in utilizing force and guile and NYPD against its own students to destroy the beautiful things that we attempt to create. I think that the university showed its hand as an imperial mainstay.
So they're upset that Columbia used the NYPD at all. The NYPD says, you got to ask me to come on campus, but I'll handle the outside of campus. You used to be a cop. So what's your reaction to these protesters going for a movement I think very few know anything about?
Well, yeah, they do know it. They know zero about it. I mean, I visited Columbia on multiple occasions and took the opportunity to talk to some of these pro-terrorist sympathizers and those who supported Hamas and asked them exactly what it is that they are lighting flags on fire for, what it is that they're assaulting Jewish members of the school for, and they had no answer. They have no idea why they're there. I'm still convinced that many of them are paid actors. They're similar individuals that we saw in the BLM riots and others throughout the city and the state. And I think the NYPD continues to hold their ground and make sure that they keep this city safe with the resources that they have. And quite frankly, Columbia should be ashamed of themselves as well as many other institutions. I mean, the fact that what we saw just, last week where the six hostages were killed, murdered at gunpoint because of the situation that we're in with Hamas. The fact that there are any Americans that are prancing around New York City, especially in some of our oldest educational institutions, places that are renowned around the world, and they are wearing T-shirts that they support Hamas, that they agree with the havoc that they're causing and the terrorism and the killing and the murders and the rapes that they've committed is absolutely ridiculous. They don't deserve to go to those schools, and quite frankly, they don't deserve to be in New York City.
I hear you. Congressman, best of luck down the stretch. You won by 10,000 votes last time against Laura Gillen. It seems like you're pulling ahead again, but it's going to be a tough fight to the end. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. Be well.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Before I take a break, let's go to Skip, WSBA, over in New York, Pennsylvania. Hey, Skip.
Morning, Brian.
What's on your mind?
I am a registered Democrat, and I don't want to leave my party, but I'd like to change it. My wife is a Chinese immigrant who came legally but stayed overstayed her visa and became illegal. We've been spending the last 4 years and over $7,000 trying to get her legal and permanent resident here. She is legal, but she's not a permanent resident. She loves Trump because she used Trump's speeches to learn to speak English when she first came to America. We went to the Trump town hall yesterday, and while there, you know, I wish Trump would, I don't know, calm down. Even Sean Hannity would have liked to have been able to mute his mic like they would in the debate because he can't stay on topic. He starts out, then he switches to something else. If he were to debate Madam Vice President, I would suggest that he spend his first 90 seconds discussing the topic and answering the question. He did the same thing in the Biden debate, in my opinion. And then spend the last 30 seconds attacking Madam Vice President, asking her, well, you make all these promises like $50,000 for small business, $25,000 for homes. How did your promise to forgive student loan debt, internet for everybody, charging stations all across the station work out? You know, you promise,
gotcha.
But you can't deliver.
Yeah, I mean, the more focused he can be, the more deliberate and direct he can be, the better he'll be off, because she, if given 2 minutes, will get into two or three topics and never get to the point. That's her weakness. I think she knows it. That's why she doesn't want to do any interviews. I think her handlers know it. That's why they won't let her do interviews. But the president puts himself out there. But you're right, that is a vulnerability. Thanks so much for the call. When we come back, we'll find out if there's indeed more to know.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. Keep in mind, it's a Saturday night, One Nation, coming up at 9 o'clock. We're going to have Judge Joe Brown, and he's one of my great guests, and he has known Kamala Harris for decades. What he has to say is going to be explosive. It's going to be insightful. You don't want to miss it. We're also going to be joined by a few of the great guests, including
the Ruthless Podcast.
Oh, yeah, the Ruthless Podcast is going to have the whole cast on with us to kick off the show. We're also going to have Kayleigh McEnany do a look at the media. So hopefully everyone will be tuning in. And also, don't forget to see me in Peekskill, History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour, BrianKilmeade.com for tickets. And get VIPs this way. I can meet you before. Just go to my website at Peekskill, New York, just outside of New York City. Now let's find out if there's indeed more to know.
You played that sound coming in.
Oh, we did. Okay.
The more to know is who's coming up on One Nation and the Peekskill Show and something else.
All right. So Jelly Roll went to prison. Not because he had to, because he wanted to. He wanted to entertain those in the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. You know, he famously has spent a lot of time there, got a lot of facial tattoos there, but also entertained there, and he thought it was a great experience. Cut 33.
For the first time in 20 years, they have brought live music to the yard.
I wrote my first song, Behind the Walls. It never feels better than to come back behind a wall and sing a song for y'all. You love drawing, if you love writing, if you love poetry, if you love listening to music, playing the guitar, I just pray that you put that passion into it and live it as much as you possibly can.
And I ain't seen the sunshine since, I don't know when. I'm stuck in Oregon State Prison.
What a show. Amazing. These guys just enjoyed the show so much.
Oh, this is dope. They gave tickets out. That's even more fun.
You can just connect with anybody, but especially guys like this, you know, gave them just a little bit of happiness.
Triple OG from OSP.
It was beautiful.
When I heard Save Me for the first time, bro, on the radio, I got clean that day.
Wow, that is pretty interesting. By the way, he was playing the song Johnny Cash wrote, Folsom Prison Blues, that he played in prison. But he didn't go to prison. People have told me this morning. I said on Fox and Friends he was in prison. He wasn't in prison. He had a rough period where he drank too much, but didn't go to jail. Next. Former President Trump thanked Brittany Mahomes for so strongly defending him after she liked a post on Instagram and got a lot of blowback because of this. Trump said this on Truth Social. I want to thank beautiful Brittany Mahomes for so strongly defending me and the fact that MAGA is the greatest, most powerful political movement in the history of the new failing country. That's a little negative. Inflation ravaging all Americans with a world that is laughing at the stupidity of our hapless leaders. It is nice to see someone who loves our country and wants to save it from doom. A little negative. What a great couple. See you both at the Super Bowl. I guess
also,
he's going to New Orleans.
A little bit of a so strongly defending me for simply liking a post on Instagram.
But then she got so much blowback and says, I'm standing strong.
Right. So, saying I'm still going to like the post.
Right. And I think that it's safe to say that she speaks for a lot of other people, but not Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift, I would be shocked, who is her running mate now. I guess they hang out together. I'd be shocked if she was for Trump, would you?
I'd be shocked if she liked one of his posts on Instagram, yes.
Next, UFC's Gilbert Burns downplays NFL's Brazil concerns. She says it's not that crazy. Here's a listen, because right now they told all these warnings to all the players. Don't leave your hotel. Just play the game tonight. Listen.
Darius Slay of the Eagles came out and said that the team has told them to stay in the hotel, that they're nothing to be worried about leaving the hotel.
No way. No way. It's a lot, especially when they have those big things. So a lot of security out there. The UFC, the same thing. UFC sent an email, don't go out. And then when they get there, I said, bro, let's come. I take a couple guys to have acai to go around. He's very nice. You should go around and look. For sure, all the football players, they look like Brazilian a little bit. They're big, they're strong, so they're not going to have any problem there.
Yep, that is right. For the first time, two NFC foes will battle in week one at Arena Corinthians Stadium in Sao Paulo, marking the first NFL game in South America. Security's been ramped up big time. That country's in chaos because it got horrible leadership. That guy is corrupt as the day is long. He spent time, Lula spent time in prison. Big fan of Fidel Castro. That was his idol. And he's pretty much got a corrupt country because of that. But if you're an NFL player, you can't go out there and fight. You can't get out there if you get jumped. You saw what happened in San Francisco. My goodness, their first-round draft pick got shot in the chest. What else can I tell you? Volvo has reversed its goal to make EVs only by 2030. Of course. Here's a quote from the CEO. However, it is clear that the transition of electric vehicles will not be linear, and customers and markets alike are moving at a different speed of adoption. We are pragmatic and flexible while retaining an industry-leading position on electrification and sustainability. So they said, we're going to back.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, in these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.